It is time now for the Border News Roundup. Friday mornings, we get a chance to check in with Marshall Helmberger, the editor and publisher of the Timberjay. It's a newspaper serving northeastern Minnesota, an independent newspaper, I should say. Marshall, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Well, happy to be here, Heidi.
Well, I am relying on you to help us understand what's new when it comes to Twin Metals and the announcement from the Biden administration.
Yeah, well, the administration announced this week that it will be starting a mineral withdrawal process. This is an effort that the Obama administration actually had started back in its final weeks, back in late 2016. That whole effort was eventually thrown out by the Trump administration, but now the Biden administration has said they want to follow through on this mineral withdrawal process, which starts out with a two-year study. They'll take a look at the economic and the environmental impacts of doing a 20-year mineral withdrawal. And this means essentially it would put a ban on any mineral leasing within about a 225,000-acre portion of the Superior National Forest. And this would be located in the Rainy River watershed just upstream of the Boundary Waters. And, of course, that's one of the reasons there's been a lot of concern about the Twin Metals project, which is right in this area, and that's the proposed Twin Metals copper-nickel mine. And they actually hold a couple of leases in that affected area. The leases actually would not be impacted by this decision, but the company has indicated that it needs a third mineral lease to implement the mine plan that they've laid out to both state and federal regulators. So if there is a moratorium on new mineral leasing, that would certainly complicate their proposal for copper-nickel mining in that Rainy River watershed. So it is a big deal, obviously, that it certainly is likely to affect Twin Metals, and they've certainly expressed disappointment in this decision. And just to lay out the process a little bit, the application for a mineral withdrawal was actually filed by the Forest Service, which had indicated back in 2016 that it did not believe that the Twin Metals mine could be mitigated in a way that would protect the boundary waters. They described it as a significant threat to the water quality of the wilderness. And so now with the Biden administration in there, they opted to reapply for this mineral withdrawal. They do that with the Department of the Interior, and that's because that's where the Bureau of Land Management's located, and the BLM has authority over federal mineral leasing. And the Forest Service had filed this about 2 weeks ago, but it didn't become official until the BLM had given its blessing. And certainly there's been lots of comment on this on both sides of the issue, but it's clear that this week's announcement is a major win for mine critics led by the Ely Base Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters. Enactment of a 20-year mineral withdrawal is the first of four initiatives that the campaign has undertaken in recent years to achieve permanent protection of the boundary waters from sulfide mining within its watershed. And the campaign is also working with 4th District Congresswoman Betty McCollum on federal legislation that would enact a permanent ban on sulfide-based mining within that portion of the headwaters of the Rainy River watershed. And it would also update state mining rules. That's another thing they're working on. And they're also seeking to advance new state legislation that would prohibit the permitting of sulfate-based mines upstream of the boundary waters. So this is kind of the first step of that process is, getting this withdrawal underway. That kind of puts a pause on any new mineral leasing in that area. And then they hope to have some legislation that would essentially enact that moratorium on a permanent basis going forward.
I was just going to ask you again, Marshall, you've reminded us in the past, because we've been talking about copper-nickel mining for, 30 years, probably,
right.
It seems
mm-hmm.
like, but about kind of the business of copper-nickel mining, and if these roadblocks weren't there, would it be up and running?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and actually it's something that we do address a little bit in our story here. Nobody has ever really seen a financial plan for the Twin Metals mine that actually shows it's going to make money. So that's always been a question. I've had my doubts about this project for a long time. And, until they actually produce an independently assessed you know, financial projection. You know, to me, this is highly speculative. But obviously, you know, they've been investing money in it. And, of course, it's money backed by Antofagasta, which is a Chilean mining company, which is, you know, most of their deposits are in Chile. You know, I guess those deposits are starting to worsen, or they're just not as rich as they used to be. The good stuff has already been mined. So they've been looking at other alternatives around the world. And, you know, Minnesota is one of the places they've been looking, which is how they got tied up here. But, you know, what was interesting was the company that preceded Antofagasta as the primary on this was Duluth Metals. And back in 2014, they had put out a pre-feasibility study which had shown pretty marginal profits and a huge upfront price tag to develop the mine. And Antofagasta had some ownership of the project at that time, but when that study came out and those financials were released, they backed away and said they weren't interested in exercising an option to take additional ownership. And right after that, Duluth Metals stock just basically circled the drain. And shortly after that, then Antofagasta was able to come in and pick up the company for, you know, pennies on the dollar. So, you know, in the end, there have always been a lot of questions about the viability of this project. I think what they're betting on is that an increase in electric cars and other further electrification of our entire energy system, you know, in order to reduce carbon emissions, that there will be increased demand for copper and that prices of copper will rise in the future. I think that's what they're betting on here. I mean, copper prices are high right now because of the shortages related to COVID, but up until that happened, you know, copper had been hovering around $2.50 to $3 a pound, and at that rate, I don't see any evidence that this mine is financially viable at this point.
There we go. Always confusing to me, but good to know about and how it changes depending on who's in power and all that kind of stuff. So we'll see what happens in terms of mining and jobs on the Iron Range. I know a lot of elected officials weighing in on this as well, since jobs seems to be both parties.
Yeah, exactly. You know. I mean, we have, certainly a lot of the local elected officials have been very critical of this decision. And, you know, again, but, you know, claims of jobs, they have to be based on some financial viability of the project. Otherwise, it's, like I said, it's highly speculative. But then at the same time, we do know that we have an existing economy that's been built up around, you know, outdoor recreation and servicing people who are coming to the wilderness to recreate and who also are, you know, investing in property up here and, you know, all of the things that happen in a community that's focused on outdoor recreation. And that's all real. We know that's here. And I think the mine supporters or critics, I should say, you know, feel that this is a much more sustainable type of economy for the long term.
Let's move on to another story. Let's talk about schools. What do you know about schools and COVID and how things are going, especially in the Ely area?
Well, the impact of the Ely School District's decision to require face masks at the school this year has definitely had an impact on their enrollment. The school district was already concerned about enrollment, which was quite low. As of September 9th, they had 530 students, and that was alarming enough. But since their imposition of the mask mandate, they have lost about another 24 to 26 students. And that appears to be related to parents deciding to move their kids to other schools, you know, as a result of that mask mandate. I mean, a lot of them did follow through on threats they had made that they were going to do that. And so that's, you know, had an impact on school enrollments around some of the neighboring areas. I know the Northeast Range School has seen, and that's in Babbitt, has seen a number of new students from Ely. I know the Charter School in Towers picked up a few extra kids as well as a result. So it'll be interesting to see how long these students remain in those new schools. I mean, you know, eventually if the, you know, COVID, the current wave, which does seem to be waning now, If this kind of passes through and the numbers drop back down to a more reasonable level, it's certainly possible that, in fact, I would expect that the school district will suspend that mask mandate. And you know, a lot of these kids may come back. So it's hard to say whether this is a permanent issue or just kind of a temporary one. So I guess time will tell on that.
And before we go, let's get an update on a story you told us about an employee from Fortune Bay Resort Casino charged in embezzlement. There was a sentencing. What do you know?
Well, there was a sentencing for Jennifer Lynn Busso, and she's of rural Orr, and she was charged with the one count of embezzlement and theft of tribal funds. And over the course of several years, she had actually been able to embezzle over $300,000. And she had admitted that, had pled guilty some months ago. I think we might have talked about that on the radio at the time. But now she was up for sentencing, and she will have to serve 8 months in prison. And she was ordered to repay $315,000. Which she admitted to embezzling. During the sentencing, her lawyer did say that, she had had health issues, medical bills that she had, that had kind of prompted her to do this embezzlement. But the prosecutors pointed out that their own examination found that she had used much of the money for, the usual things you might expect, fancy hotel rooms, travel, RVs, boats, stuff like that. So apparently was not quite the amount of sympathy as Budo's attorney might have wanted to elicit. That solves the issue, I guess, for now. Justice has been served here, and most of the money apparently has already been repaid to the band by Fortune Bay's insurance company. And so it will be the insurance company that will be wrestling, I'm sure, over the next many years with the defendant here to recover those funds.
It's Marshall Helmberger. This has been the Border News Roundup. You can read and see more at timberjay.com. Marshall, thanks so much. We'll check in next week.
You bet. Thanks, Heidi.
I'll see you tomorrow. If you open the door.